if we saw things as animals see them. Imagine looking down at the earth through the eyes of a soaring bird, moving through life in three dimensions like a whale, or seeing the world through sound waves the way bats do. Who hasn't dreamed of such thrilling possibilities? The attraction of the Dr. Dolittle story is that it brings animals to life in big screen, living color. What would you say if I told you that Dr. Dolittle's secret was more than just creative fiction? Perhaps you're imagining this secret from a human perspective. You're wondering if I'm telling you that there's a verbal way to talk to your dog, perhaps with the use of a phrase book that translates your language into his. What would his language look like, sound like, you wonder? Would it include the words sit, stay, come, and heal? Would you have to shout the translations, or could you whisper them? Would you have to learn how to whimper and bark, sniff your pet's behind, and how would your dog answer you back? How would you translate what he was saying? As you can see, creating a dog-to-human phrasebook, the way, say, an English-to-Spanish phrasebook is created, would be a very complicated effort indeed. Wouldn't it be simpler if there was a universal language that every species could understand? Impossible, you say. Even human beings don't all speak the same language. True, but that hasn't kept people from trying to find a common language for centuries. In the ancient world, all the higher-class educated people learned Greek. That way, they could all read and understand the most important documents. In the Christian era, anybody who was anybody knew how to read and write Latin. Today, English is at the top of the language food chain. I learned this the hard way when I first arrived in America 14 years ago. Believe me, if you're not born speaking it, English is a monster of a language to learn from scratch. Yet everyone from the Chinese to the Russians now accept it as the international language of business. Humans have sought other ways to breach the language barrier. No matter what language you speak, if you're blind, you can use Braille. If you're deaf, you can understand any other deaf person using international sign language. Mathematics and computer languages cross many linguistic borders and allow humans of different tongues to converse easily with one another, thanks to the power of technology. If humans can succeed in designing these collective languages, can't we create a way to converse with the other species on the planet? Isn't there a language we can learn that means the same thing to every creature? Good news. I'm happy to report that the universal language of Dr. Dolittle already exists, and humans didn't invent it. It's a language all animals speak without even knowing it, including the human animal. What's more, all animals are actually born knowing this language instinctually. Even human beings are born fluent in this universal tongue, but we tend to forget it because we are trained from childhood to believe that words are the only way to communicate. The irony is, even though we don't think we know the language anymore, we are actually speaking it all the time. Unknowingly, we are broadcasting in this tongue 24/7. Other species of animals can still understand us, even though we may not have a clue how to understand them. They read us loud and clear, even when we're unaware that we're communicating. This truly universal interspecies language is called energy. Energy in the wild. How can energy be a language? Let me give you some examples. In the wild, different animal species intermingle effortlessly. Take the African savanna, or a jungle, for instance. At a watering hole in a jungle, you might see monkeys and birds in the trees, or on a savanna, different plant eaters, such as zebras or gazelles, wandering around, happily drinking out of the same crystal-clear pond. All is peaceful, despite the many different species sharing the same space? How do they all get along so smoothly? How about a less exotic example? In your own backyard, you may have squirrels, birds, rabbits, even foxes, all happily coexisting. There's no trouble until you rev up your lawnmower. Why? Because all these animals are communicating with the same relaxed, balanced, non-confrontational energy. Every animal knows that all the other animals are just hanging out, doing their own thing, drinking water, foraging for food, relaxing, grooming one another. Everybody's feeling mellow, and no one's attacking anyone else. Unlike us, they don't have to ask one another how they're feeling. The energy they are projecting tells them everything they need to know. In that sense, they are speaking to one another all the time. Now that you've got this peaceful vision in your mind, imagine this. Suddenly, a new animal enters your backyard or approaches our imaginary jungle waterhole, projecting a completely different energy. This new energy could be something as minor as one squirrel trying to plunder another's stash, or a gazelle jockeying another gazelle for a better drinking position at the oasis. It could also be as serious as a hungry predator seeking to subdue its next prey. Ever notice how a whole group of peaceful animals can turn scared or defensive in an instant, sometimes even before a predator has shown itself on the scene? They probably got a whiff of its scent, but it's also probable that they sensed the energy the predator was projecting. What's always amazing to me about the animal kingdom is that even if a predator is near, all the other animals can usually tell if it's safe to stay around it or not. Imagine being introduced to a man you knew to be a serial killer. Would you be able to relax in his presence? Of course not. But if you were another kind of animal on this planet, you would probably be able to sense whether the serial killer was on the prowl or simply kicking back. Animals immediately recognize when a predator is projecting a hunting energy, sometimes even before they spot the predator itself. As humans, we are so often blind to these nuances in animal energy. We think a tiger is dangerous at all times, when really, if he's just eaten a 300-pound deer, he's probably more tired than treacherous. The moment his tummy gets empty, however, he's a different animal. All instinct, all survival energy. Even your backyard squirrel will pick up on this subtle difference. Yet we humans tend to be blind to what in the animal kingdom is pretty much a flashing red light. Here's an example of animal energy that folks who live in the American South can probably relate to. On a sunny day in Florida, Louisiana, or the Carolinas, you'll see giant alligators sunning their leathery bodies on the banks of swamps, all over expensive, exclusive golf courses. Meanwhile, golfers are teeing off a few feet away. Herons and cranes and turtles are happily sunning themselves right next to these terrifying reptiles. 80-pound old ladies are walking their teacup-sized dogs on footpaths just inches from the alligator's swamp. What's going on here? It's simple. The other animals, from the turtles to the teacup chihuahuas, are aware, on an instinctual level, that these fearsome predators aren't in a hunting mode at the moment. One thing you can be sure of, when the same big creature's tummy starts to rumble and his energy shifts into hunting mode, the rest of the animals will be gone in the blink of an eye, except maybe the golfers, but they are one of the strangest species in nature, and even modern science hasn't figured them out yet. Energy in humans. When it comes to energy, we humans have much more in common with animals than we usually like to admit. Imagine one of the most ruthless jungles in the human world. The high school cafeteria. Picture it as a watering hole where different species, in this case the cliques of jocks, nerds, and stoners, peacefully intermingle. Then a bully accidentally bumps into a smaller guy's food tray. The energy released by that interaction will ripple right through the entire room. Ask your teenager if this isn't true. And exactly as in the animal kingdom, this energy shift doesn't even have to be as blatant as a shove. Let's say the little guy in the cafeteria is having a bad day. He's failed 2 tests in a row and is in a weak state of mind. He happens to look up and accidentally catch the eye of the bully. Maybe the bully was just minding his own business. But as soon as he picks up on the weaker guy's diminished energy, the whole dynamic between them changes in a split second. In the animal kingdom, that's called survival of the fittest. Let's take this concept beyond the school lunchroom and think about our society as a whole. Right or wrong, we in America expect our leaders to project a dominant, powerful energy, like that of a Bill Clinton or a Ronald Reagan. Some powerful leaders project a charismatic energy that infects and energizes everyone around them. Consider Tony Robbins. Martin Luther King Jr. projected an energy that was what I call calm assertive, the ideal energy for a leader. Though Gandhi was also a leader, his energy was of a more compassionate nature. It's interesting to note that Homo sapiens is the only species on the planet that will follow a wise, kind, compassionate, or lovable leader. Humans will even follow an unstable leader, but that's another book in itself. As difficult as it may be for us to understand, in the animal kingdom, a Fidel Castro would win out as leader over a Mother Teresa any day. In the animal world, there is no morality, no right and wrong. Conversely, animals never cheat or lie their way to power. They can't. Other animals would figure them out in a heartbeat. Nature's leaders must project the most obvious and uncontestable strength. In the animal kingdom, there are only rules, routines, and rituals based on survival of the strongest, not of the smartest or fairest. Ever hear of the smell of fear? That's not just an expression. Animals sense vibrations of energy, but smell is their next strongest sense. And in a dog, energy and scent seem to be deeply connected. In fact, dogs empty their anal glands when they are afraid, emitting a smell that's distinctive not only to other dogs, but to most animals, including us. A dog's sense of smell is connected to the limbic system, the part of the brain responsible for emotion. In his book, The Dog's Mind, Dr. Bruce Fogel cites studies from the 1970s that showed that dogs can detect butyric acid, one of the components of human perspiration, at up to 1 million times lower concentration than we can. Think of lie detector sensors that can pick up minute changes in the perspiration on a person's hands when she is being deceptive. In essence, your dog is a living, breathing lie detector. Do dogs actually physically smell fear in us? They certainly can sense it instantly. Countless joggers and mail carriers relate this harrowing experience. Running or walking past a house and causing the dog there to bark, growl, or even charge the fence or gate. Now, this could be a dog that has adopted the role of protector of the house and takes that role very seriously. And too many mail carriers and joggers have the scars to show how powerful, aggressive dogs, what I call red zone dogs, get out of control. Red zone dogs are serious business, and I'll address them in depth in a later chapter. For the purposes of understanding how dogs sense emotional states, imagine this as you walk by a house with a red zone dog in it. Perhaps the barking dog has a secret. He may be more afraid of you than you are of him. Once you freeze up in terror, however, the balance of power instantly changes. Does the dog pick up on your energy shift through his sixth sense? Or does he smell some change in your body or brain chemistry? Science hasn't spelled it all out in layman's terms as of yet. But in my opinion, it's a combination of both. I can be sure of this from decades of close observation. You cannot bluff a dog the way you might be able to bluff a drunken poker buddy. Once you shift into the emotion of fear, that dog instantly knows he has an advantage over you. You are projecting a weak energy, and if the dog gets out, you are much more likely to be rushed or bitten than if you had tuned out the barking and simply gone on with your day. In the natural world, the weak get weeded out quickly. There's no right or wrong about it. It's just the way life on Earth has worked for millions of years. Energy and emotion. The most important thing to understand about energy is that it's a language of emotion. Of course, you never have to tell an animal that you're sad or tired or excited or relaxed, because that animal already knows exactly how you're feeling. Think back on some of the beautiful stories you've read in publications like Reader's Digest and People magazine. Stories of pets who have comforted, even saved their sick, depressed, or grieving owners. These stories often include comments like, "It was almost as if he knew what his owner was going through." I'm here to assure you that yes, these animals do know exactly what their owners are feeling. A French study concluded that dogs may actually also use their sense of smell to help distinguish between human emotional states. I'm not a scientist, but after a lifetime of being around dogs, my opinion is that, without question, dogs can sense even the most subtle changes in the energy and emotions of the humans around them. Of course, animals can't always comprehend the context of our issues. They can't distinguish whether we're heartbroken over a divorce or losing a job or misplacing a wallet, because those very human situations mean nothing to them. However, such situations create emotions, and those emotions are universal. Sick and sad are sick and sad, no matter what your species. Animals aren't in tune only with other animals. They seem to be able to read the energy of the earth as well. History is full of anecdotal tales of dogs who have appeared to predict earthquakes, or cats who have hidden in the cellar for hours before a tornado. In 2004, a half day before Hurricane Charley hit the coast of Florida, 14 electronically tagged black-tip sharks who had never before left their home territory off Sarasota, suddenly headed off for deeper waters. And think of the terrible Southeast Asian tsunami of that same year. According to eyewitnesses, an hour before the wave hit the coast, captive elephants for tourist elephant rides in Indonesia started wailing and even broke their chains in order to flee to higher ground. All over the region, zoo animals fled into their shelters and refused to come out. Dogs would not go outdoors, and hundreds of wild animals at the Yala National Park in Sri Lanka, leopards, tigers, elephants, wild boar, deer, water buffalo, and monkeys, also escaped to safe ground. These are some of the miracles of Mother Nature that continue to astound me. They are a brilliant illustration of the powerful language of energy at work. One of the most important things to remember is that all the animals around you, especially the pets with whom you share your life, are reading your energy every moment of the day. Sure, you can say anything that pops into your mind, but your energy cannot and does not lie. You can scream at your dog to stay off the sofa until your face is blue, but if you aren't projecting the energy of a leader, if, deep down inside, you know you're going to let him on the sofa if he begs you long enough, he's going to know what your real bottom line is. That dog is going to sit on the sofa as long as he damn well pleases. He already knows you're not going to follow through on your screaming. Because dogs often perceive loud vocalizing by humans in an excited, emotional state as a sign of instability, he'll be either unaffected by your tantrum or confused and frightened by it. He certainly won't relate it to your rules about the couch. The calm, assertive personality. Now that you understand the powerful language of energy, my next job is to help you understand how to harness it to foster better communication between you and your dog. It takes a dog only a few seconds to determine what kind of energy you are projecting, so it is important that you be consistent. With your dog, you want to project what I call calm, assertive energy at all times. A calm, assertive leader is relaxed, but always confident that he or she is in control. Now, the word assertive has gotten an unfair bad rap lately. Maybe it's because it is so similar to the word aggressive, but their meanings are worlds apart. Think of people in popular culture. No matter what side of his politics you adhere to, you've got to admit that Bill O'Reilly is angry aggressive. He yells, "Shut up," interrupts, and tries to get his way through bullying. In most everyday situations, being angry aggressive can work against you. It's simply not an energy-efficient way to get things done, and it's really not good for your blood pressure. An angry aggressive dog would not make a good pack leader, because the other dogs would perceive him as unstable. I haven't come across many people who are calm aggressive in my job, though I suppose you could describe the villains in James Bond movies that way. They're always plotting to blow up the world without breaking a sweat or spilling their martinis. In any case, calm aggressive is not an energy state that's natural to the non-human creatures in the animal kingdom. But calm, assertive personalities? They are the leaders of the animal world. In our human landscape, they are few and far between, but they are almost always the most powerful, impressive, and successful people on the block. Oprah Winfrey, the number one role model for my own professional behavior, is the epitome of calm, assertive energy. She is relaxed, even-tempered, but undeniably powerful, and always in charge. People everywhere respond to her magnetic energy, which has made her one of the most influential and one of the wealthiest women in the world. Oprah's relationship with one of her dogs, Sophie, is another story. Like many of the powerful people who hire me to help them with their dogs, Oprah had some issues in sharing her vaunted calm assertiveness with Sophie. In the years that I've been helping people and their dogs, I've observed that many type A power brokers, directors, studio heads, movie stars, doctors, lawyers, architects, have no trouble being dominant and in control in their jobs. But the moment they arrive home, they let their dogs walk all over them. These people often see their life with their pet as the only area where they can let their softer side show. This is all incredibly therapeutic for the human, but it can be psychologically damaging for the animal. Your dog needs a pack leader more than he needs a buddy. But if you're looking for a role model in calm, assertive energy, turn your channel to the Oprah Winfrey Show and watch her interact with her guests and her audience. That's the kind of energy you should be aiming for when you interact with your dog, cat, boss, or your kids. Fake it till you make it. What if you're not naturally a calm, assertive person? How do you react when a problem pops up? Are you panicky and excitable, or defensive and aggressive? Do you tend to handle problems as if they were a personal assault upon you? It's true that energy doesn't lie, but energy and power can be focused and controlled. Biofeedback, meditation, yoga, and other relaxation techniques are excellent for learning about how to better control the energy you project. Spending 8 years in intensive judo training as a boy made controlling my mental energy second nature for me. If you're high-strung, anxious, or overly emotional, dead giveaways when animals are reading your energy, such techniques can make a big difference in how you relate to your pets. Learning to harness the power of the calm, assertive energy within you will also have a positive impact on your own mental health and on your relationships with the humans in your lives. I guarantee it. I often counsel my clients to use their imaginations and employ visualization techniques when they feel stuck in trying to project the right energy to their dogs. There are a lot of wonderful self-help, psychology, and philosophy books available to help you learn to harness the power of your mind to change your behavior. Some of the authors who have most influenced me are Dr. Wayne Dyer, Tony Robbins, Deepak Chopra, and Dr. Phil McGraw. Acting techniques, such as those pioneered by Konstantin Stanislavski and Lee Strasberg, are also excellent tools for transforming the way you relate in the world. In the first season of my National Geographic Channel show, Dog Whisperer with Cesar Millan, I came across a case that offered an excellent example of how we can use our powers of visualization to instantly transform our energy and our relationships with our dogs. Sharon and her husband Brendan had rescued Julius, a sweet, lovable pit bull Dalmatian mix who, unfortunately, came to them afraid of his own shadow. Whenever they took him out for walks, he would tremble all over and walk with his tail between his legs, and would bolt for the safety of their house the moment he got a chance. When guests came over, he would freeze up and cower under the furniture. When I worked with the couple, I noticed that Sharon became extremely anxious and frightened whenever Julius acted afraid or pulled on his leash during walks. She was so worried about Julius that she would try to comfort him with words. And when he wasn't comforted, she would just throw her hands up in helplessness. It was clear to me that Julius was picking up on Sharon's fearful energy, which was greatly intensifying his own fear. When Sharon told me she was an actress, however, I realized that she had a powerful tool at her disposal that she wasn't taking advantage of. The best actors learn to dig deep inside themselves, to use the power of thought, feeling, and imagination to transform themselves into different characters and to switch instantly from one emotional state to another. I asked Sharon to reach into the same toolkit she drew upon when she performed on stage or in a film and concentrate on a very simple acting exercise. To think of a character she identified as being calm and assertive. Because of her training, Sharon immediately understood what I was asking her to do. Without hesitation, she answered, "Cleopatra." I then suggested that she become Cleopatra every time she walked Julius. It was thrilling for me to watch her the first time she gave that acting exercise a try. While walking Julius, Sharon began to imagine that she actually was Cleopatra. Right before my eyes, her posture became straighter, and her chest higher. She raised her head and gazed imperiously around her, as if she were the queen of all she surveyed. Thanks to the same acting abilities she'd spent a lifetime honing, suddenly she was aware of her power and her beauty, and she naturally expected everyone, especially her dog, to obey her every wish. Of course, Julius had never gone to acting class, but because he picked up on her energy shift, he had no choice but to become Sharon's scene partner in her Cleopatra fantasy. The change in that cowering pit bull Dalmatian was immediate. Once he realized he was walking with a queen, he instantly became more relaxed and less fearful. After all, what dog would be afraid with the all-powerful Cleopatra holding his leash? Julius and his owners have worked hard and come a long way. It took many months of dedicated daily practice, but a year later, Julius is totally secure on their walks and now even welcomes strangers into their home, all thanks to the power of calm, assertive leadership and with a little help from Cleopatra. Calm, submissive energy. The proper energy for a follower in a dog pack is called calm, submissive energy. This is the healthiest energy for your dog to project in his relationship with you. When people come to the Dog Psychology Center and watch my pack in action, they are often astounded at how mellow a group of 40 to 50 dogs can be 90% of the time. That's because my pack is made up of calm, submissive, mentally balanced dogs. The word submissive carries with it negative connotations, just as the word assertive does. Submissive doesn't mean pushover. It doesn't mean you have to make your dog into a zombie or a slave. It simply means relaxed and receptive. It's the energy of a group of well-behaved students in a classroom or of a church congregation. When I give my dog behavior seminars, I always thank my audience for being in a calm, submissive state. That is, open-minded and able to converse easily with one another. When I learned how to be calm, submissive to my wife, it improved my marriage 100%. For dogs and humans to truly communicate, the dog must project a calm, submissive energy before a human can get him to obey her. As dog owners, we don't ever want to be perceived as the submissive ones. Even when a dog is doing search and rescue, he's not assertive. He's active, submissive. Though that search and rescue dog is meant to be out in front of the handler, scratching excitedly at piles of rubble, the handler will first sit the dog down and wait until he is in a submissive state of mind, and only then will give him the signal to begin the search. Dogs who work with handicapped people also must be the submissive ones in the relationship, even if their owners are blind or confined to wheelchairs. The animals are there to help people, not the other way around. Body language. Your dog is constantly observing you, reading your energy. He is also reading your body language. Dogs use body language as another means of communicating with one another. But it's important to remember that their body language is also a function of the energy they're projecting. Remember the example of Sharon and Julius, where simply thinking about being Cleopatra inspired Sharon to stand up taller and prouder? The energy fed the body language, and in turn, the body language reinforced the energy. The two are always interconnected. You can learn to interpret your dog's body language by the visual clues he or she gives you. But it's important to remember that different energy can determine the context of a posture. It's like those pesky words called homonyms in English. Words that sound exactly the same but mean different things, like red, R-E-A-D, and red, R-E-D, or flee, F-L-E-E, and flea, F-L-E-A. For the non-native English speaker, it takes a little while to learn how to distinguish between such words. But of course, it all comes down to context. How a word is used is what determines its meaning. It's the same with dogs and body language. A dog with his ears back may be signaling calm submission, which is the appropriate energy for a follower in a pack. Or he may be signaling that he is afraid. One dog mounting another may signal dominance, or it may simply be play behavior. The energy always creates the context. May I sniff you? As I mentioned earlier, scent can also function as a language for dogs. Your dog's nose, millions of times more sensitive than yours, provides him with a huge amount of important information about his environment and the other animals in it. In nature, a dog's anal scent is his name. When two dogs meet, they'll sniff each other's behinds as a way of introduction. Since they don't have phone books, dogs can tell other dogs where they live and where they've roamed by urinating on a signpost, a bush, a tree, a rock, or a pole. When a female is in heat, she'll deposit her scent through urine all throughout her territory, placing a kind of personal ad for the male dogs in the neighborhood, who may show up on her owner's doorstep the following morning without her poor human owner knowing how in the world they got invited. Through scent, dogs can also find out if another dog is sick or what kind of food it has been eating. As in the studies of dogs and their ability to sniff out emotional changes in humans, scientists have for many years been trying to understand the miraculous power of a dog's nose to discern all sorts of subtle information. In September 2004, the British Medical Journal published the results of a Cambridge University study that proved that dogs could sniff out bladder cancer in urine samples at least 41% of the time. For years, there had been anecdotal evidence of such miraculous feats, but now science is actively working to research how dogs can help detect diseases at much earlier stages than even some high-tech equipment can detect them. You know those whole-body CT scan machines, where you lie down for a few moments and supposedly get a complete diagnosis of all your bodily systems? That's pretty much what dogs do when they first meet you. They use their noses to give you a whole-body scan, check you out, find out where you've been and what you've been doing lately. In dog etiquette, you're supposed to let them do it. At my dog psychology center, when a new dog enters the pack's territory, it is only polite for him to remain still while everybody in the pack comes up and smells him. If the dog stands quietly, allowing the others to finish sniffing, he will be accepted more easily into the pack. If he moves away, the other dogs will chase him around until they're done sniffing. A sign that a dog is antisocial toward other dogs is that he is uncomfortable or aggressive about being sniffed. That's a dog that hasn't learned any manners, like a human who won't shake hands upon introduction. When a person enters the gate of my center and walks through the dog pack, the dogs will do the same thing to her. Many people find it intimidating or just plain terrifying to have a pack of 40 very scary-looking dogs descend on them and start sniffing away. A person shouldn't look at or touch the dogs during this process, but the dogs should be allowed to surround that person and smell her. That's the only way they can become comfortable with a new animal of any species, by learning to distinguish her by her scent. I'm not Caesar to my dogs. I'm their pack leader, which is Caesar's scent and energy. While smelling you is a way for your dog to recognize you, projecting the correct energy is the key to becoming your dog's pack leader. We'll go deeper into the pack leader concept It is the cornerstone of your healthy relationship with your dog. But first, it's important to remember that your dog doesn't see the world the same way you do. Once you learn to experience your dog as an animal first, and not a four-legged human, you will be better able to understand his language of energy and truly hear what he is saying to you. Chapter 3. Dog Psychology. No Couch Required. In the last chapter, I define and discuss energy as a concept of communication between humans and animals. Whether you know it or not, you and your dog are communicating all the time through energy, with body language and scent thrown in for good measure. But how do you interpret the messages your dog is sending you? And how do you know you are projecting the right kind of energy back to her? It begins by understanding dog psychology, by going back to your dog's inborn nature and trying to see the world through her eyes, not your own. Humans are from Saturn. Dogs are from Pluto. For any relationship to truly achieve harmony, it can't be one-sided. The needs of both parties must be fulfilled. Think about male-female relationships. When I was first married, it took me a long time to realize that the way I saw the world as a man was very different from the way my wife saw the world as a woman. The things that made me happy and content in the relationship were not always the same things that made her happy and content. And as long as I fulfilled only my own needs, we would have real problems. It was my way or the highway, partly because I was selfish, but mostly because I didn't know there was another way. If I don't understand the psychology of the most important woman in my life, then how can we truly communicate? We can never become connected to each other, and a relationship without connection is vulnerable to divorce. I had to read a lot of relationship psychology books to learn to see the world through illusion's eyes, and believe me, my doing so made a huge difference in our marriage. My goal here is to help you make the same kind of positive changes in your marriage with your dog, based on a new understanding of your dog's true nature. It's only with this knowledge that you can achieve the kind of connection between species, that true man-beast connection that you desire in your heart. The first mistake so many of my clients make in relating to their dogs is similar to the one many men make in relating to women. They assume that both their minds work in exactly the same way. Most animal lovers insist on trying to relate to their dogs using human psychology. No matter the breed, German Shepherd, Dalmatian, Cocker Spaniel, Golden Retriever, they truly see all dogs as furry, four-legged people. I suppose it's natural to humanize an animal because human psychology is our first frame of reference. We've been raised to believe the world belongs to us and that it should run the way we want it to. However, as clever as we humans are, we aren't clever enough to completely undo Mother Nature. Humanizing a dog, the source of many of the problem behaviors I am called in to correct, creates imbalance. And a dog who's out of balance is an unfulfilled and, more often than not, troubled dog. Time and time again, I'm called in to work with a dog that is essentially running her owner's life, exhibiting dominant, aggressive, or obsessive behaviors, and creating a household in turmoil. Sometimes these issues have gone on for years and years. Often a baffled owner will say, "The problem is, she thinks she's a person." "No, she doesn't. I promise you, your dog knows full well that she's a dog. The problem is, you don't know it." Different pasts, different presents. Animals and humans all evolved differently from different ancestors and with different strengths and weaknesses to help them survive in the world. In his book, Wild Minds, What Animals Really Think, Professor Mark D. Hauser describes different animals as having different built-in mental toolkits for survival. I like this toolkit analogy because it's a simple way to begin to understand nature's great diversity. Some tools we all share, such as the universal language of energy, which I described earlier. Some tools are specific to one species. Many tools are the same across more than one species, scent, for example, but may play a greater role in the survival of one species over another. Each of these evolutionary tools becomes the toolbox of an animal's mind, so that every species has a psychology that is in some ways very specific and unique. Giraffes have their own psychology. Elephants have their own psychology. You wouldn't expect a lizard to have the same psychology as a human, would you? Of course not, because a lizard evolved in a different environment and lives a completely different life from a human's. Lizards are built for completely disparate functions than we are. Going back to the toolkit analogy, you wouldn't expect a doctor to bring a computer programmer's toolkit to the operating room. You wouldn't expect a plumber to bring a violinist's tools to fix your sink. They all have separate tools because they all do very different jobs. Although dogs and humans have interacted closely, perhaps even interdependently, for thousands of years, dogs were also built for jobs very much unlike the jobs we humans were designed by nature to do. Think about it. Considering your different jobs and different toolkits, why would you expect your dog's mind to operate in the same way that yours does? When we humanize dogs, we create a disconnect for them. By humanizing them, we're going to be able to love them the way we would love a human, but we're never going to achieve a deep communion with them. We're never really going to learn to love them for who and what they truly are. It may seem to you, as you read this book or watch my TV show or attend one of my seminars, that I keep hitting these same points over and over. Dogs don't think like humans. Dog psychology isn't human psychology. If you've heard enough of it already and are all set to start relating to your dog as a dog, congratulations and more power to you. But you'd be amazed at the number of clients I have and the hundreds of people I speak to or who write me who are reluctant and sometimes downright unwilling to let go of the picture they have in their minds of their dogs as cute little people. Their dogs are their babies, and by thinking of them otherwise, their owners are afraid they'll somehow lose the connection between them instead of strengthen it. During a question and answer period at the end of one of my seminars, a clearly disheartened woman stood up and said, "Do you realize that everything you are telling us goes completely against everything we've ever thought about our dogs?" I had to say to the audience, "I'm sorry, humans." Some of my clients are heartbroken and actually shed tears when I tell them that in order to solve their dog's problems, they have to start perceiving and treating their canine companions in a way that is completely different from how they've perceived them, sometimes for years. Often when I leave a consultation, I fear that the dog I've just met is never going to get the chance to live a peaceful, balanced life because her owner seems unlikely and unwilling to change. If you are reading this and fear that you may be one of these people, please take heart. Think of getting to know your dog for who she really is as an exciting new adventure. Consider the great privilege you will be given, being able to live side by side with and learn to see the world through the eyes of a very special member of a completely different species. Remember that by making a commitment to change, you are making a commitment to your dog. You are giving your dog an opportunity to reach her natural potential. You are offering another living creature the highest form of respect by letting that creature be what she is supposed to be. You are building the foundations of a new connection that will bring you and your dog even closer. So what exactly is so different about dog psychology? To begin to understand it, we must again look at how canines live in nature when humans are out of the picture. Dogs begin their lives in a very different way from humans. Even our most basic senses are different. Nose, eyes, ears, in that order. When a mother dog gives birth, her puppies are born with their noses open, but their eyes and ears are closed. The earliest, most vital thing in a dog's life, her mother, appears to her first as scent. The mother is, first and foremost, scent and energy. A human infant can also distinguish his mother's smell from the smells of other humans, so scent is important to us as well, but it's not our most important sense. For man, seeing is believing. When you hear that some guy named Caesar Milan can control a pack of 40 dogs without a leash, you're not going to believe it until you see me do it. Well, for a dog, smelling is believing. If she doesn't smell it, she can't figure it out. It's not real to her. And how's this for a comparison? While we humans have only about 5 million scent receptors in our noses, the average grown dog has about 220 million. In fact, as handlers of tracking and cadaver dogs can tell you, dogs have the ability to sniff out smells that we can't even pick up using sophisticated scientific equipment. In short, a puppy grows up to see the world using its nose as its primary sensory organ. Along with scent and energy, a puppy will experience touch as she wriggles close to her mother to nurse, long before she even knows what she looks like. Not until about 15 days after her birth will she open her eyes and start to take in the world through sight. And not until around 20 days after birth will her ears start to function. But how do we most often try to communicate with our dogs? By talking to them as if they understood us, or by yelling commands at them. Nose, eyes, ears. My clients get tired of my repeating this, but I'll say it again. Nose, eyes, ears. Commit that to memory. It is the natural order of senses in dogs. My point is that from the very beginning, from the development of their first basic tools of survival, dogs experience the world in a completely different way than we do. They, in essence, experience a different world. Even the experience of birth for a puppy is far removed from that of a human infant. For a dog, the calm, assertive energy of the mother permeates everything. Think about a typical birth scenario for a human. Imagine the stereotypical male delivery room role. Breathe, honey, breathe. Think about your favorite sitcom, with the husband pacing the waiting room or fainting at the sight of blood during the delivery. Remember that famous I Love Lucy episode when Ricky and the Mertzes rehearse everything for Lucy's trip to the hospital, but when the time finally comes, they all fall apart? For first-time human parents, a birth is usually very stressful and frenetic. It's a different story in the animal world. In her natural environment, a mother dog will not be afraid of labor, nor will she need doctors, nurses, midwives, or Lamaze coaches to cheer her on. She builds her nest, goes to it by herself, and in many cases becomes very territorial about the experience. Have you ever seen a mother dog take her newborns into a closet or under a bed where she cleans them of the placenta and begins to feed them? It's a private thing for her. That, immediately, is another difference between humans and dogs. We bring the whole family into the delivery room. Grandma, grandpa, cousins, along with a video camera. Cigars, flowers, balloons. We create parties around having babies, which is a very beautiful ritual for us. But again, a distinction between humans and dogs is the very way that life begins for us. Being a dog is not less or more than being a human. But life for a dog is fundamentally a very different experience from day one. Let's look at the early development of dogs as a window into their minds. While puppies are tiny, a mother dog presents herself in the den, and the puppies must find her, must come to her. She doesn't go to them. As they grow older, sometimes she walks away from them or even pushes them away when they approach her to nurse. In nature, this is where both discipline and natural selection begin. The weak puppies will be the ones who have the hardest time finding her and who can't compete when it's time to feed. If a mother dog senses a weakness in one of her puppies, she won't look out for it. It may even die. You can see right there the enormous difference between humans and dogs. We are the only species in the animal kingdom that takes extra care of a weak infant. There's no neonatal intensive care unit in a dog pack. It isn't that the mother dog doesn't care for her offspring. It's just that in the natural world of dogs, caring means ensuring survival for the pack and for future generations. A weak puppy who can't keep up endangers not only the whole pack by slowing it down, but in genetic terms, it's also likely to grow up weak, to breed more weak puppies. It seems harsh to us, but in the natural world, the weak are always weeded out early. To a puppy, its mother begins as scent and energy, the same calm, assertive energy that you will read much more about throughout this book. The hormone progesterone, which is still strong in the mother from pregnancy, helps enhance this calm energy, inhibiting her fight-or-flight response so she can concentrate on raising her puppies. Calm, assertive energy is the very first energy that puppies experience, and it will be this energy that they associate with balance and harmony for the rest of their lives. From the very beginning of their lives, they learn to follow a calm, assertive leader. They also learn calm submission, the natural role of followers in the animal kingdom, and especially in the dog world. They are learning patience. Dogs' food doesn't arrive on a Federal Express truck. They have to wait for the mother to return to the den in order to feed. They learn that survival means both competition with their litter mates for food and cooperation with their mother, by default, their first pack leader. The proper way to meet a dog. This isn't a book about dog biology, but there's a reason why it's important to know how your dog's body and mind interrelate and how your dog developed from the puppy he or she once was. Its mother is the first introduction a puppy will have in the world. She's the first other being a puppy will meet. Now, contrast the calm, assertive scent and energy emitted by a mother dog with how we normally introduce ourselves to a dog. What do we usually do when we see a cute little puppy? "Ooh," we exclaim, loudly, usually in a high-pitched voice we reserve for babies. "Come here, you cute little thing!" By doing this, we are introducing ourselves to the dog using sound first, and not only sound, but usually very excited, emotion-charged sound. What we're doing is projecting excited emotional energy, which is the furthest from calm, assertive energy that we can get. To a dog, emotional energy is weak and often negative energy. So, from the get-go, we're telling the dog that we don't exactly have it all together. And what happens next? We approach the dog, not the other way around. We rush up to her, bend down to her level, and give her affection. Usually a pat on the head, before she even knows who we are. By this point, the dog has already figured out that we really don't understand anything about her. She's also getting the clear message that we're coming to her. And from that point on, we are signing a contract that says we are the followers and she is the leader. Do you blame her after we've made such an unstable